Chapter 8. How Plagues End. Dr. Rieu resolved to compile this chronicle so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done them might endure, and to state quite simply what we learn in time of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in men than to despise. Albert Camus, The Plague, 1947. One day in 1902, an American second lieutenant named George Marshall crossed a small river on the island of Mindoro, Philippines, to pay a visit to a local leader and his three young daughters. The attractive girls were apparently the main draw. They laughed and made chit-chat and sang delightfully. Social visits were conducted in the mornings in those days to avoid the oppressive heat. Marshall left, but later that same day, he had cause to return to the village, where he joined the funeral for the same four family members who had welcomed him only hours before. They were dead from a cholera outbreak that struck precipitously, eventually killing 500 of the 1,200 residents of the hamlet. 46 years later, now Secretary of State George C. Marshall, best known for the Recovery Act that got Europe on its feet after World War II, movingly recalled that grim experience when he was a young officer in opening remarks to an international conference of tropical disease experts held in Washington, D.C. Like many Americans who felt optimistic and even triumphalist in the post-war period, Marshall envisioned a world where deaths like the ones in Mindoro would become relics of history. Vanquishing infectious disease was not an insoluble medical challenge, he declared, but an international problem, and it should be solved by pooling of the genius and the resources of many nations. This optimism was widespread and sustained. Writing in 1963, physician and anthropologist T. Aidan Coburn, an expert in ancient diseases who helped manage malaria outbreaks during the war, also noted his expectation that, within some measurable time, such as 100 years, all the major infections will have disappeared. In 1978, Dr. Robert Pietersdorf, an international leader in infectious diseases, opined in remarks to future infectious disease doctors, "Even with my great personal loyalty to the specialty of infectious disease, I cannot conceive a need for 309 more infectious disease experts unless they spend their time culturing each other." Though these claims sound naive now, the period leading up to them and through the 1950s had seen astonishing advances. Many of the most devastating infectious diseases were in retreat, brought under control by a combination of factors that included rising wealth, better sanitation, improvements in food preparation, and, as a coup de grace, the invention of antibiotics, as we saw in Chapter 3. Penicillin, discovered in 1928, was a miraculous drug, and there were many more classes of antibiotics useful against bacteria of all kinds that followed. Vaccines became available in rapid succession for a wide range of diseases, from pertussis, 1914, to tetanus, 1924, to polio, 1953, to measles, 1963. The discovery of insecticides that killed mosquitoes and other insects that transmitted malaria and other diseases also raised hopes. In 1948, Paul Hermann Mueller was awarded a Nobel Prize in Medicine for the discovery of DDT. The identification of a path to eradicate smallpox 150 years after Jenner's experiment with cowpox and our ultimate success against this scourge, it was declared eradicated in 1980, also fed this confidence. Of course, smallpox had the salient advantage of lacking any animal reservoir, so once gone from humans, it was gone forever. Polio nowadays offers a similar opportunity, and in 2016, after many years of coordinated international effort and support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, there were only 46 cases of this disease worldwide. The mid-20th century optimism about disease eradication was quite broad. But smallpox and polio are exceptional cases, and these optimistic views were held despite the occurrence of the 1957 and 1968 influenza pandemics, an oversight that is hard to understand in hindsight. Of course, much of this triumphalism pertained to the rich Western countries. In the rest of the world, people still suffered and died from infectious diseases in great numbers in an ongoing reflection of global socioeconomic inequality. In any case, it was not clear why human beings should be favored to win against microbes in an evolutionary arms race. Microbes have been around a lot longer than humans, are more numerous, do not mind dying, and can mutate rapidly, evading our defenses. How could we truly bring about their end? As molecular biologist Joshua Lederberg observed, pitted against microbial genes, we have mainly our wits. And often, as we have seen, these wits are deployed not so much in the development of sophisticated pharmaceutical armaments, but rather in the very basic implementation of the simplest of tools to fight our enemy, namely, staying 6 feet apart. While we can use our wits to win, perhaps, against a pathogen causing a particular outbreak, and while we can occasionally eliminate a pathogen like smallpox altogether, it is extremely doubtful we can win against all pathogens. Infectious disease care and control seem more realistic objectives than eradication. As historian Frank Snowden has argued, the emergence of the worldwide pandemic of HIV in the 1980s was the death knell of this optimism. Still, it took some time to reset expectations. In 1992, the U.S. government allocated just $74 million for infectious disease surveillance. In 1994, the CDC founded a new journal, Emerging Infectious Diseases, wherein many outstanding articles about COVID-19 would be rapidly published in 2020. In 1996, President Clinton issued a statement noting that emerging infectious diseases were one of the most significant health and security challenges facing the global community, and, of course, the United States itself. In 1998, the U.S. Department of Defense warned that historians in the next millennium may find that the 20th century's greatest fallacy was the belief that infectious diseases were nearing elimination. The resultant complacency has actually increased the threat. In 2000, the CIA labeled infectious disease as a serious threat. Infectious diseases were seen as non-traditional challenges, especially in the post-Cold War era, when military threats to the United States were seen as diminished. And in 2003, as we saw, President George W. Bush launched 2 global initiatives targeting HIV and malaria. From this perspective, nothing about the appearance of SARS-2 in 2019 should have been surprising. Rumors of the end of infectious diseases were, we can say with confidence, greatly exaggerated. Globalization, mass migrations, rapid airline links, the ever-rising size of the human population, and humanity's increasing localization in huge and densely packed metropolises also contribute to the persistence of deadly infectious diseases. Outbreaks of novel pathogens reflect, among other things, changes in the way humans come into contact with animals. In fact, 2 of the biggest global challenges humans face, extreme weather events like hurricanes and droughts, and periodic outbreaks of serious diseases, may be linked by climate change. People driven from their homes by changes in the weather, or people clearing new land for cultivation, may come into contact with animals, who may also be driven from their homes in ways that increase the likelihood of emergence of new pathogens in our species. A review in 2008 documented that, contrary to the hopes from 40 years earlier, there had been 335 new infectious diseases in the period between 1940 and 2004, and that their threat to global health was actually increasing. It's worth noting that all of our modern plagues are zoonoses, coming to us from wild animals. Our other major contagious diseases, from smallpox to TB to measles, mostly came to us from animals that we domesticated beginning 10,000 years ago, which has allowed us time to co-evolve with them to some extent and develop at least some genetic resistance. These were pathogens that once afflicted the wild ancestors of our cows, pigs, sheep, chickens, and camels. For example, measles appears to have entered our species quite recently, in the 6th century BCE, from a progenitor in cattle that caused a disease called rinderpest. This coincided not only with humans living so close to cattle, domesticated millennia earlier, but also with the establishment of large cities. These were crucial because once a pathogen arrives among us, in order for it to stay endemic and endure, it needs a population size above the critical community size. If a host population is too small, the pathogen runs out of runway and auto-eradicates. Human populations need to be large enough to sustain the ongoing transmission of any particular pathogen. These observations help explain the perplexing fact that when Europeans came into contact with American Indians, the transfer of deadly germs was all one way, with a possible exception of syphilis. There were no domesticated animals in the New World, other than the Peruvian llama, which meant humans there had no opportunity to evolve genetic resistance to particular diseases that originated in such animals before circulating among people. And population sizes were smaller, even in the great civilizations of the Maya, Inca, and Aztec. Compared with Eurasia, the New World was thus a microbial paradise, devoid of major endemic infectious disease. Domesticating animals and bringing their pathogens up close to humans in a sustained way had some other untoward consequences. Animal husbandry and agriculture more broadly contributed to the invention of cities in the first place by providing a steady supply of food. And this in turn fed into the development of far-flung trade routes and high-density habitation, which was often coupled with poor sanitation. These developments paved the way for the epidemics that began to afflict the great ancient civilizations, including Greece and Rome. In the 2nd century CE, the city of Rome had over 1 million inhabitants. But these agglomerations of humans and their institutions were able to survive major outbreaks too, for reasons we saw in Chapter 6. So the picture is complex. Devastating epidemics that brought societies low and fostered social changes, but that were then brought under control by the power of humans living together, collaborating, and learning ways to fight off disease using even more ancient capacities with which our species was naturally equipped. All of these features of how humans have lived for the past few thousand years are still with us. Why should infectious diseases not be? And like the serious plagues before it, the COVID-19 pandemic will be a historical watershed. How does SARS-2 compare with other major infectious killers in the United States over the past century? It's clear that, with the mere introduction of this new pathogen into our species, our life expectancy has been reduced. An exogenous force has changed our surroundings for the worse. Like widespread contamination from a nuclear accident or a global change in temperature, it makes it harder for us to survive. Quantifying this overall impact is not straightforward. But we can start by simply counting deaths. It bears repeating that given the intrinsic epidemiological parameters of SARS-2, had we done nothing to address it, the virus could easily have killed 1 million people in the United States during the first wave and countless more around the world, and may yet do so before the end. From an individual perspective, it can be difficult to know what metric to use to evaluate risk of death. For instance, if we should look at it in absolute terms or relative to other causes. In Chapter 2, we saw that even if a person gets the disease, unless he or she is older than 70 or 80, the chance of death, the CFR, is still less than 1%. To be clear, this is pretty bad from the point of view of a doctor. To frame this a bit more, consider the chances of death once a person is hospitalized with COVID-19. Overall, the risk is on the order of 10 to 20%, though, again, this is very sensitive to age and illness severity. Roughly speaking, the risk of death of a 40-year-old patient who is hospitalized is about 2 to 4%. This is in the range of the risk of death of a 70-year-old patient who is hospitalized for a heart attack in the United States. In fact, at every age, being hospitalized with COVID-19 is meaningfully worse than being hospitalized for a heart attack in terms of the likelihood of making it out of the hospital alive. But that is only the risk for people who actually come to be infected or come to be hospitalized. What about at baseline? Out of the U.S. population of 330 million, about 3 million people die each year, for a crude death rate of 9.1 people per thousand. If, for the sake of argument, we assume that over a year, the coronavirus pandemic causes 1 million deaths in the United States, the crude death rate would rise to 12.1 per thousand. The average person's absolute risk of dying from the virus would remain small, roughly a 3 out of 1,000 chance, 1 million extra deaths from COVID-19 divided by 330 million people. That seems low, but this level of mortality would still far surpass all of the threats to life an average person faced that year, making COVID-19 the number one cause of death. One careful analysis of weekly mortality data from Sweden compared deaths per day in 2020 to prior years, quantifying the excess deaths and assessing the impact on mortality across all ages, using the method invented by William Farr in the 19th century, discussed in Chapter 2. It estimated that SARS-2 was a kind of shock that, if sustained, would lop off 3 years of life expectancy from men and 2 years from women. Even in a rich, functional society like Sweden, the pathogen would have that sort of intrinsic force. Another important subtlety here is that while the great majority of deaths from COVID-19 occur in the elderly, this is true of virtually all other causes of death too. To fully understand the impact on mortality, leaving aside the further substantial impact on disability and morbidity, requires us to compare the virus's effect on overall risk of death after taking age into account. Being young and not fearing COVID-19 because fatal disease seems rare is a reasonable posture, though not caring about infecting others is not. But it is crucial to recognize that, at baseline, young people do not face quantitatively large risks of death of any kind. Nevertheless, COVID-19 increases the baseline risk of death at every age. Most parents worry about all kinds of uncommon calamities happening to their children. But if we worry at all about our children drowning or being kidnapped, we should rationally be worrying more about COVID-19. How can the extra risk of death from COVID-19, even if low in absolute terms, be put into perspective, given the background risk faced by people at any given age? Sophisticated demographic estimates offer a way of thinking about this. For instance, the death of 125,000 Americans over a 3-month period corresponds to artificially aging everyone by 1.7 years in terms of their risk of mortality. In other words, during such a period, a 20-year-old would have the risk of death faced by a 21.7-year-old in normal, non-pandemic times, and a 60-year-old the risk of a 61.7-year-old. These numbers may again seem trivial, but in population terms, they are not. Of course, if the number of deaths from the pandemic during the period were larger because we did nothing to mitigate it, the numbers would rise proportionately. If 500,000 people were to die during the first 6 months or so of the pandemic, through October 2020, this would translate into a roughly 3.3-year increase, such that, say, a 60-year-old would face the risk of a 63.3-year-old, and so on. How could such a large number of people dying over such a relatively short time result in these individual risks that might not seem like that big a deal? As we have seen repeatedly, SARS-2, while serious, is clearly not as deadly as the major plagues of prior centuries. And at baseline in the 21st century, especially in the more developed world, death is a relatively uncommon statistical event for most people in most years of their lives. Even an 80-year-old man has a risk of death in the next year that is only 5%. And since the greatest risk for this pandemic is experienced by the elderly, it can be easier to lose sight of the mortality impact. But most important to me as a public health expert and physician, these small changes in individual mortality scale up very quickly and become really alarming on a population level. A better way to come to terms with the worrisome nature of COVID-19 is to return to the population level and compare it to other epidemics using the metric of years of life lost relative to other threats. In this way, demographers Joshua Goldstein and Ronald Lee were able to generate the estimates shown in Figure 16 of your PDF. For comparison purposes, they assume that 1 million people will die from COVID-19 by the time the pandemic is over in the United States after several waves, which is not inconceivable. but the numbers in the figure can just be adjusted linearly if the death count winds up being different. For instance, the bar would be half as large if only 500,000 people die. After taking into account the size of the population, the age distribution, and other background causes of death, we can then compare the gravity of the COVID-19 pandemic to other threats. It's clear that COVID-19 is a serious disease, though not as bad as the Spanish flu, and perhaps one-third as bad as the overall loss of life caused by HIV over its nearly 30 years of afflicting our nation. These sorts of demographic calculations also allow us to benchmark the financial benefits of saving lives against the financial costs of shutting down the American economy during the deployment of the NPIs. By using a standard benchmark of $500,000 as the economic value of a year of life, or $10 million per life regardless of age, we can estimate that 1 million coronavirus deaths, at the rough age distribution at which they occur, would be worth about $6 trillion. Even at the highest end of a range of estimates of the consequences to our economy, including the expenditures by our government, we do not reach that sum. Strictly from an economic perspective, our response was commensurate to the threat posed by the pathogen. It's a bad virus. A very basic way that pandemics have one sort of end has to do with the use of the non-pharmaceutical interventions to stop transmission of the pathogen. New cases can be driven to zero, as we saw in China and New Zealand. But this is not the real end of a plague. It's a kind of false bottom, because the pathogen is still out there and will return the moment people resume normal interactions, as we saw with the recurrences in the United States over the summer of 2020. After its dramatic initial appearance, SARS-2 will ultimately become endemic. It will regularly circulate among us at some low, steady level. This is connected to the second kind of end, which we have already considered, herd immunity. Here, the pathogen is still around, but it has a much more difficult time reestablishing itself. This resembles a well-vaccinated population for any infectious disease. There are only occasional small outbreaks among non-immune people. By 2022 or so, we will reach this outcome naturally or via vaccination. Of course, if we do rapidly develop and distribute a safe and effective vaccine, we could reach herd immunity with fewer deaths. Based on the fundamental R-naught of SARS-2, as we saw in Chapter 2, up to an estimated 60 to 67% of the population could be affected, or roughly 200 million people in the United States. The necessary percentage could be lower, closer to 40 to 50%, given that social network structure means that different people spread the virus to different extents, as we also saw in Chapter 2. Or it could be higher, if the epidemic moves extremely fast and we overshoot the level required for herd immunity. Whatever the exact percentage, as a pathogen spreads, some people will die and others will recover and become immune, so eventually the virus will run out of places to go. This is the ordinary, natural way that, biologically speaking, epidemics end. This is what we mean when we say that a pathogen is under control. But sometimes, plagues are so devastating that a society never recovers. It's very important to emphasize that as bad as COVID-19 is, it's not remotely as bad as epidemics of bubonic plague, cholera, or smallpox that have killed much larger fractions of the population and that have had much larger and longer-lasting effects. Those types of plagues are even associated with the iconography of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, pestilence riding side by side with war, famine, and death. Those epidemics vindicated the adage that too few of the living were left to bury the dead. Such plagues end in utter destruction. Some American Indian tribes were almost entirely wiped out after European colonization, with less than 5% of the population left alive. Here is one indigenous account of a 1519 epidemic, possibly of measles or smallpox, that afflicted the Mayans in what is today Guatemala. The people could not in any way control the sickness. Great was the stench of the dead. After our fathers and grandfathers succumbed, half of the people fled to the fields, The dogs and the vultures devoured the bodies. The mortality was terrible. So it was we became orphans. Even bubonic plague, which sometimes took whole cities, did not destroy whole societies. Thankfully, this sort of end is very rare. As we saw earlier, from a Darwinian point of view, it does not suit a pathogen's interest to kill its victims, since it would rather that its hosts move around and transmit it to other people. Typically, with time, viruses become less lethal as a result of this preferential spread and survival of milder strains. It is still too early to know how SARS-2 might mutate, and over what time frame. Over the short term, it's possible that the virus could change to be either better or worse for us, in terms of its transmissibility, lethality, or both, even though any long-term changes are likely to be positive for us, the unfortunate hosts. Many thousands of mutations in SARS-2 have already emerged naturally, but most of those mutations do not affect the action of the virus. As of the summer of 2020, there is not much evidence that the virus has mutated to be less severe, and there is some possible suggestion that one circulating variant might have become more transmissible, involving the D614G mutation in the spike protein. Early clinical observations from China, reported in the popular press, suggested that the virus might have meaningfully different variants that caused primarily lung damage in some patients and primarily extrapulmonary damage, gut, nerves, kidney, or heart in other patients. It's possible that the variation in the lethality of outbreaks from place to place, for example, comparing New York City to Seattle, could relate, in some small part, to the virulence of the individual viral variants that were prevalent. But none of this was clear in the summer of 2020. Still, one way a pandemic of a pathogen such as SARS-2 can come to an end is that the virus mutates over a period of years to get much milder. In fact, it's possible that the four coronavirus species that cause the common cold are distant echoes of long-ago pandemics, now domesticated through a combination of herd immunity and genetic change. There is some intriguing evidence that this might have happened with the OC43 coronavirus species that causes the common cold. By performing genetic analyses on a set of coronaviruses and developing a molecular clock based on fundamental mutation rates, scientists have been able to infer that OC43 arrived in our species from an animal reservoir sometime around 1890. At that time, a pandemic was raging that has traditionally been ascribed to a species of influenza. It is thought that the pandemic of 1889 began in May in Bukhara, a city in modern Uzbekistan. Known as the Russian flu, and also sometimes the Asiatic flu, it traveled quickly through Russia and then into Western Europe and the rest of the world. In the first week of December 1889, it struck its first major city, St. Petersburg, with a vengeance, infecting about half of the population, which is roughly the usual percentage for herd immunity for similar pathogens. From there, following rail links, it spread over the winter, attacking Berlin, Brussels, Paris, Vienna, Lisbon, Prague, and other major capitals, and afflicting various leaders, such as the Tsar of Russia, the King of Belgium, and the Emperor of Germany. In a series of annual waves through 1892, it caused approximately 250,000 deaths in Europe. It reached the United States in the second week of January 1890. In fact, the pandemic took only 4 months to circumnavigate the globe, peaking in the United States just 70 days after it had struck St. Petersburg. At that time, transatlantic travel by boat took about 6 days. The attack rates varied from 45% to 70% across geographic areas. The CFR ranged from 0.1% to 0.28%, and the R0 was 2.1, though the reproduction number varied substantially from one city to another. In London, the 1890 epidemic was anxiously anticipated by newspapers, which had reported outbreaks in other cities using the recently invented technology of the telegraph, publishing often gruesome and sometimes exaggerated accounts of the epidemic. Then, As with the COVID-19 pandemic now, some people thought that the epidemic was not real and that it had simply been started by Telegraph. Yet, as the anonymous author of an article about the epidemic in the British medical journal The Lancet noted, the numbers crowding to the hospitals and dispensaries form sufficient answer to that suggestion. And the illness was indeed worse than the common colds and catarrhs that are ordinarily rife at this season. The author continued, there is a growing tendency amongst the better educated to regard the epidemic as something almost too trivial for serious consideration, and this idea is often pushed to the extreme of thinking that it can be treated disdainfully by homely remedies and by sufficient energy of self-control. But it is one thing to deny the reason for panic and another to urge the recklessness of unconcern. The newspapers in New York City were indeed initially unconcerned. It is not deadly, not even necessarily dangerous, the Evening World wrote, before noting that it will afford a grand opportunity for dealers to work off their surplus of bandanas. But as the death toll rose in the United States, people began to take it more seriously. As usual, New York City was hard hit, and during the first week of January 1890, the city reported a record number of deaths, 1,202. On a 6th Avenue elevated train this morning, fully one half of the passengers were coughing, sneezing, and applying handkerchiefs to noses and eyes, and many of them had their heads bundled up in scarves and mufflers, the Evening World later reported. They were a dejected and forlorn-appearing crowd. It has been speculated that this pandemic was the H3N8 strain of influenza, or possibly the H2N2 strain. But it's just possible that the 1889 pandemic was a major pandemic of a coronavirus. Clinicians' real-time observations of the disease when it struck London in 1890 described it as having three types of symptoms. Sometimes pulmonary symptoms predominate, in other cases gastrointestinal troubles appear to form the main feature, and in both there may be frequent complaints of racking pains in the head or in the limbs. Interestingly, COVID-19 similarly shows these three clinical types of illness, with emphasis on the respiratory, gastrointestinal, or musculoskeletal and neurological systems. However, while patients with influenza clearly manifest respiratory symptoms, cough, sore throat, congestion, and shortness of breath, musculoskeletal symptoms, such as muscle pains or weakness or headache, are not as typical, and neither are gastrointestinal symptoms, such as nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea. Central nervous system symptoms were also more pronounced in that pandemic than is typical of influenza, according to historical accounts, and the OC43 coronavirus is known to be neuroinvasive. Another suggestive piece of evidence comes from work that indicates that the Russian flu showed a disproportionate increase in case fatality with increasing age and possibly had a backward L-shaped mortality function, which is unusual for influenza. Remember that influenza usually manifests a more pronounced U-shaped function. OC43 and a particular bovine coronavirus species show remarkable similarities in their genetic sequences and in the chemical structures of the proteins that elicit an immune response. And by comparison with other coronaviruses afflicting other animals, it is possible to reconstruct the evolution of OC43. The timing of separation from its bovine coronavirus cousin, that is, when the cold virus afflicting us went its separate way, evolutionarily speaking, proves to be approximately 1890, as noted earlier. This jump to humans would have been similar to the ones made by SARS-1 and SARS-2. It turns out that in the latter half of the 19th century, there was a highly infectious and deadly respiratory disease in cattle. Though we cannot be sure, it's possible that the cause of those outbreaks in cattle was the bovine coronavirus that OC43 so resembles. We do know that from 1870 to 1890, many industrial countries engaged in major culling operations. During this slaughter, it seems quite possible that humans could have come into contact with cow respiratory secretions containing a coronavirus species mutated from its bovine coronavirus ancestor that would go on to cause the 1889 pandemic and eventually remain with us as OC43. After being among us for a century, this virus would have further evolved to be a mild pathogen that just causes the common cold today. In addition to the virus evolving to be milder, our modus vivendi with it reflects an additional factor. Since OC43 is so widespread, most people are exposed to it in childhood and are spared any serious illness. Remember the backward L-shaped mortality function. Thereafter, if they are exposed to OC43 again later in life, the virus just causes a mild cold, if it causes anything, because the hosts have some memory immunity. That's a stark difference from the situation now, as SARS-2 is having a field day in a wholly immunologically naive population. But it's possible that once we reach herd immunity in the coming years, people will simply be exposed to the SARS-2 virus as children, have a mild disease most of the time, get some immunity, and then avoid serious disease if they are re-exposed thereafter. Such a scenario is a quite possible eventual end to the story of SARS-2. We are familiar with other viruses that follow this pattern, causing mild illness in children or in adults who have already experienced the illness as children, yet causing severe disease in adults who have not previously been exposed. Chickenpox has a mortality rate 20 times higher in 15 to 44-year-olds than it does in 5 to 14-year-olds, but it does not usually cause severe problems for adults who had it as children. Similarly, Epstein-Barr virus causes mild disease in young children, but it can result in infectious mononucleosis in young adults and even be a risk factor for the onset of multiple sclerosis. Other evidence suggests that if people are infected with this virus as children, they might simply have a minor upper respiratory disease, but if infected for the first time as adults, it might put them at risk for Hodgkin's lymphoma. The pathogens evolved to respond to us, but we, at a slower pace, also evolved to respond to them. Infectious diseases have been a part of our evolutionary history for so long that they have left a mark on our genes. For instance, humans have evolved genetic changes that have proven useful in coping with malaria beginning over 100,000 years ago, tuberculosis over 9,000 years ago, cholera and bubonic plague over 6,000 years ago, and smallpox over 3,000 years ago. Infectious pathogens, even if non-epidemic, have arguably been a crucial selective pressure throughout the evolution of our species. The primary killers of human beings across evolutionary time are other human beings. Humans do not have any natural predators that substantially affect survival, except for our microscopic enemies. The SARS-2 virus is a lot less lethal to people of reproductive age, and it can be combated with the life-saving tools of modern medicine, so the impact on human evolution is surely going to be minimal. But, at least in theory, another way epidemics end is that hosts evolve to be resistant. And in fact, we may already have naturally occurring genetic variation in our species that affects the severity of COVID-19 in different populations, which would lay the groundwork for such evolution. Over generations, this can result in changes to the genetic makeup of the afflicted populations. For example, over many millennia of exposure to malaria, populations in regions of the world where the pathogen is endemic evolved a number of genetic differences to help them survive, ranging from changes in levels of an enzyme known as G6PD to changes in hemoglobin structure. Northern Europeans, however, were not exposed to malaria and did not evolve such genetic resistance. They therefore fared very poorly when traveling to, or seeking to colonize, parts of the world where malaria was endemic. Conversely, for diseases like smallpox, where Europeans had some genetic resistance and childhood immunity, the indigenous people they came into contact with or subjugated died in great numbers. For just one example from our ongoing catalog of such depressing cases, consider the steamboat St. Peter's, which traveled up the Missouri River in 1837. On or about April 29th, when a deckhand was showing signs of smallpox, three indigenous women boarded the boat and subsequently returned to their village. The disease then spread rapidly among the Mandan people, who had no natural genetic resistance. In July, the Mandan numbered about 2,000. By October, there were, by some accounts, fewer than 30. Infectious diseases such as smallpox were arguably the most consequential factor in the decimation of indigenous populations throughout the colonization of the Americas, beginning in the 15th century, compounding other horrors, including warfare and enslavement. Sometimes these diseases were even deliberately used as weapons. An analysis spearheaded by anthropologist Ripon Malhi provides insight into the possible lingering genetic impact of such a catastrophe, illustrating how natural selection can work brutally on human beings. The ancient Tsimshian people, an indigenous community in the Prince Rupert Harbor region of British Columbia, were well adapted to local diseases, but not foreign maladies like smallpox. Working with the Tsimshian, Malhi compared the skeletal DNA of 25 individuals who resided in the region 500 to 6,000 years ago to the DNA of 25 living Tsimshian. There were differences in the prevalence of several immune-related genes between the two populations. For example, one variant, called HLA-DQA1, was found in nearly 100% of ancient individuals, but in only 36% of modern ones, with an estimated genetic shift about 175 years ago. That timing corresponded with widespread smallpox epidemics in the region. A demographic model based on the genetic analysis showed that, in keeping with historical accounts, nearly 80% of the community died in the decades after encountering the Europeans. Similar work has revealed analogous impacts for other deadly historical epidemics. For instance, one investigation identified convergent evolution between populations of Europeans and Roma, thought to have originated in India, both of which were afflicted by the Black Death, for certain genetic variants involved in the immune response to Yersinia pestis. Along with the fact that these genetic variants are relatively absent in populations largely spared the bubonic plague, this suggests that the pestilence positively selected for this genetic shift. This is an active area of research, and more studies of ancient DNA are needed for a fuller picture. While genetic adaptation to an epidemic can positively select for resistance traits that offer descendants protection from a pathogen, in some cases there can be negative consequences, such as an increased risk of genetic disease because of these mutations. The most well-known example is sickle cell anemia, a genetic variant causing deformed, sickle-shaped red blood cells that block small vessels and can lead to a host of problems, including premature death, although this is less frequent in modern times. Scientists were originally perplexed about why such a harmful genetic variant could be so widespread. But in 1954, geneticist Anthony C. Allison noticed a correspondence between the prevalence of sickle cell disease and malaria. This was a landmark study of human genetic susceptibility to infectious diseases. It turns out that having the genetic variant that causes sickle-shaped red blood cells confers some immunity to malaria. Other genetic disorders may have become prevalent in part due to the resistance they provided from infectious disease. Cystic fibrosis is an inherited disorder characterized by inflammation, tissue damage, and destruction of the lungs and pancreas, and, until quite recently, it usually led to premature death. It is probable that the high cystic fibrosis rate among people of European descent reflects genetic advantages it confers with respect to infectious disease. Scientists think the agent it protects against is most likely tuberculosis, but it could be cholera or typhoid. During the SARS-2 pandemic, geneticists have searched for genes that might be associated with susceptibility or resistance to the novel virus in hopes of identifying patients at special risk or of detecting possible drug targets by using natural human variation as a clue to what might be an effective pharmacological strategy. Initial work has identified certain genetic variants that occur unusually frequently in patients with the worst COVID-19 symptoms. COVID-19 patients with blood type A are about 50% more likely to need oxygen therapy and be put on a ventilator than patients with other blood types. And individuals with blood type O experience a protective effect. Ironically, this pattern is the reverse of that seen in the case of survival from cholera. A cluster of six genes on chromosome 3, including a gene known to affect ACE2 and a gene involved in the immune response to airway pathogens, is also associated with worse disease severity. So these findings all make physiological sense. And this cluster of genes, it turns out, was introduced to our species from Neanderthals and happens to be especially prevalent in Southeast Asia. These observations about human evolution indicate that, over very long periods, measured in thousands of years, pandemics end by reshaping our species. While such existing genetic variation, to the extent that it occurs, is not likely to play a material role in the course of the COVID-19 pandemic, with a possible exception of some small and localized populations who may happen to share a mutation that makes them less susceptible, it highlights the enduring ways that the social intersects with the biological when it comes to infectious disease. Over very long time frames, we reach an uneasy genetic truce with pathogens. So we will reach herd immunity, or the pathogen will evolve to be less lethal, or, after a very long time, humans will evolve to be resistant. That is the biological end of the story. But pandemics are also sociological phenomena, driven by human beliefs and actions, and there is a social end to pandemics too, when the fear, anxiety, and socioeconomic disruptions have either declined or simply come to be accepted as an ordinary fact of life. In a narrow biomedical perspective on disease, historian Alan Brandt has argued, the social and environmental context is often discounted as a cause of, much less a treatment for, the condition. Physicians dispense magic bullets intended to restore sick patients to health. But, as Brandt shows, infections and epidemics are about much more than the germs that cause them. Who gets sick, what we do about it, and even what counts as sickness in the first place are all culturally specified. This is true of all kinds of illness, from an influenza or cholera outbreak due to the dislocation of war, to deaths from cigarettes or diabetes arising from the marketing of consumer products. The patient may be the one suffering from disease, but the roots and meaning of ill health often lie in social circumstances. If we see pandemics purely as a function of biological details, such as the mutations that make it possible for the pathogen to leave bats and spread in humans, or the pharmacokinetics of drugs in our bodies, we may be lulled into thinking that there is nothing we can do to prevent or arrest such events. But if we see pandemics as sociological phenomena as well, we can more clearly recognize the role of human agency. And the more we see our own role in shaping the emergence and unfolding of pandemic disease, the more proactive and effective our responses can be. It is tempting to call the SARS-2 pandemic a perfect storm, a virus mutated in just the right way, in just the right host, acquired just the right epidemiological parameters in terms of its R-naught, CFR, latency period, and so on, had just the right serendipitous encounter with its very first victim, and appeared at just the right time during the annual Chunyun migration at a point in history when international air travel existed. But the perfect storm metaphor implies that the pandemic is an anomaly or that it is wholly unforeseeable. Yet pandemic disease is neither of those things. Even natural disasters, like the earthquake in Haiti in 2010, or actual storms, like Hurricane Katrina in 2005, that have devastating social and mortality consequences, are not perfect storms. Earthquakes and hurricanes seem to be completely independent of human action, but long histories of economic inequality and the neglect of crucial infrastructure in both Haiti and New Orleans contributed substantially to the death toll. Because pandemic disease is seen through human eyes, it is also stamped with powerful symbolic meanings that in turn affect how we react to what is happening. The COVID-19 pandemic assumed a significance that transcended mere host pathogen biology. Masks, for example, the purpose of which is simply to physically stop the spread of virus-laden respiratory droplets, became one such symbol. masks came to evoke issues of liberty and communality and were transformed into politicized emblems of either freedom, if one did not wear them, or virtue, if one did. This debate was culturally specific to America. In many other countries, people did not see wearing masks as a political act. The controversy over what to call SARS-2 was another example of humans assigning arbitrary meaning to a seemingly factual issue. Calling it the Chinese virus highlighted the already fraught relationship between China and the United States and imbued this topic with ambient concerns about racism. Donald Trump and others exploited this when they called it the Wuhan flu and Kung flu. Yet, as we have seen, many pathogens used to be named for their origins. And the impact of symbolic meaning could even be found in a survey of American beer drinkers, 38% of whom would not buy Corona beer under any circumstances after the pandemic hit. We generate narratives of what is happening during a pandemic that are partially true and partially false, reflecting our hopes and fears. For instance, the existence of a routine and tolerated disease that people know as the seasonal flu complicated efforts to make sense of and cope with the much deadlier COVID-19. Since people's closest point of reference to the novel disease was a familiar illness that is viewed by many as a hassle but not a big risk, compounded further by the tendency to call any number of minor colds the flu, and also by the great range of severity manifested by SARS-2, people struggled to respond optimally to the threat conceptually and therefore practically. This transformation of a biological entity into a social symbol greatly complicates efforts to control epidemics. This is most obvious in epidemics of sexually transmitted diseases in the past century. Such illnesses were used as rhetorical vehicles to demand the reform of sexual practices in soldiers in World War II and in gay men in the 1980s and 1990s, turning an infectious disease into a moral problem, and thus taking the focus away from effective methods of controlling it. Such transformations have happened with other plagues, which have always assumed religious, moral, and political overtones, as we have seen. Social variables and values also play a role when we think about for whom a pandemic has ended. For the elderly, the chronically ill, the poor, the imprisoned, and the socially marginalized, the SARS-2 pandemic might continue to be a threat biologically long after the majority of the population has moved on psychologically and practically, and long after overall levels of the virus are low. This is another way that social attributes will structure when the pandemic ends. We saw this tension in the summer of 2020 as working parents and many child development experts strongly advocated for children to return to suitably prepared schools in the fall, while others, including representatives of teachers' unions and families with health risks, argued against it. These parties saw the disease differently and therefore acted differently. This social construction of COVID-19 means that the end of the pandemic can also be socially defined. In other words, plagues can end when everyone believes they are over, or when everyone is simply willing to tolerate more risk and live in a new way. If everyone willingly risks infection and resumes a semblance of normal life, or, implausibly, if everyone decides to employ physical distancing forever, then the epidemic can be said to have ended, even if the virus is still circulating. We got a glimpse of this phenomenon as well in the summer of 2020, as different states, tired of the lockdowns, acted as if the epidemic were over, even though, biologically speaking, it was not. It was wholly understandable that everyone was eager to leave the epidemic behind as quickly as possible. But the epidemiological reality did not submit to our desires. The pandemic was still claiming roughly 1,000 lives per day, although Americans seemed inured to it. Many people, and not just self-interested politicians, seemed to believe the SARS-2 epidemic could end by fiat. In early May 2020, as the United States began to ease the non-pharmaceutical interventions, Thomas Frieden, the former director of the CDC, observed, We're reopening based on politics, ideology, and public pressure, and I think it's going to end badly. It is one thing to determine what the epidemiology of the situation demands, but conclude that the economics countermands it or that the public has had enough. But it is quite another to ignore the epidemiology and pretend that nothing bad is going to happen. In July 2020, states in the South faced overloaded hospitals and skyrocketing case counts, and again, many people seemed surprised. Houston recapitulated some of what had happened in New York City. One day, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, was saying that the situation was under control, and then, 3 weeks later, like New York politicians before him, he was saying that the worst is yet to come. A reasonable standard for states to reopen for business was 14 days of declining coronavirus cases, but virtually no state waited to meet that standard before opening again. Americans had clearly lost the appetite for wide-scale physical distancing measures, at least at the levels of overall mortality then present. Higher levels might change their minds. As feared, the first round of reopenings after the initial lockdowns in the summer of 2020 did not go well in some large population centers. It's unclear what was gained from the haste and the lack of effort to prepare the public for what could happen and for the real trade-offs involved in opening schools and businesses during a time of contagious disease was also dispiriting. The lack of scientific literacy, capacity for nuance, and honest leadership hurt us. Another reason that the commitment to addressing the pandemic waned over the summer of 2020 was that the serious illnesses and deaths were still mostly happening offstage. While over 130,000 people had died by the end of June, nearly half of them were in nursing homes, already isolated from the broader society, and most other people who died early on did so in hospitals that were overrun, so they often died alone. This meant that few people had personal experience with the impact of the virus. People sheltered separately, and those who died were not numerous enough or visible enough, except to their families, to highlight the threat, as we saw. Yet, as the pandemic continues to unfold in late 2020 and 2021, there will be more deaths, and as more people become personally familiar with the disease because they know someone who has died, attitudes will change. Over the immediate pandemic period, in order to return to any semblance of normalcy, the United States will require much more widespread use of masks and laws and policies mandating their use, and much more widespread testing on the order of 20 to 30 million tests per day nationwide. As of July 2020, the country was performing only roughly 800,000 per day. Basically, every worker who is in contact with other workers will need to be regularly tested. If the tests cost $10 each, the national expense would be about $1.5 billion per week, but that is still much cheaper than another massive economic shutdown. The virus is far too prevalent in most states in the United States to use contact tracing as an effective tool, though other sorts of electronic tools could help facilitate voluntary self-isolation. And reductions in social mixing via bans on gatherings will surely have to be present for a couple of years. Employers will also have to redesign workplaces and business venues to allow for physical distancing. Schools will need to move teaching outside and make many other changes that will require national investment. And a safe and effective vaccine, when it becomes available, has to be rapidly distributed and widely adopted, meaning that a massive public education campaign will be required, ideally with highly trusted and visible spokespeople like actor Tom Hanks, who had COVID-19 himself, and others seen as credible on this subject, like Dr. Fauci. Ignorance about the benefits of vaccines or resistance to them will need to be vigorously fought back. This is an enormously complex issue, as some of those who have expressed resistance are not anti-vaxxers, but instead harbor concerns about the extraordinary speed with which the vaccine is being developed and feel mistrust of the government given its inept handling of the pandemic generally. Still others will want to wait some time to see if adverse effects emerge. We therefore need a major public education initiative to pave the way for vaccine adoption, if an effective one is even found, and there was not much evidence of such an effort as of the summer of 2020. As Alan Brandt observed, many questions about the so-called end are determined not by medical or public health data, but by sociopolitical processes. I've seen this for years in the American response, or lack thereof, to mass shootings, automobile fatalities, rising suicide rates, and drug overdoses. After much anxiety and commentary, people eventually seem willing to accept an affliction that would have been intolerable at a prior point in time. The reverse can happen too. One of the reasons the mid-20th century polio outbreaks generated so much public interest, despite relatively low levels of afflicted children, was that it seemed so culturally aberrant to see children dying of infection in an age of space travel. Americans saw polio as something that had to be wiped out. And so it was. In some ways, our response to the pandemic can even be seen through the lens of psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's famous stages of coping with death. Americans began with denial and anger, moved on to bargaining and depression, and will end with acceptance, which will mark the final sociological end to the pandemic. In 2015, Bill Gates released a popular TED Talk entitled, "The Next Outbreak, We're Not Ready," in which he articulated the serious threat posed by pandemics. It has been viewed over 36 million times. The CDC has, for many years, maintained information on its websites and released many dozens of reports on pandemic preparedness, as have other governmental bodies. Our nation has countless well-trained epidemiologists, and many experts have been sounding the alarm. Yet because plagues are only in our distant collective memory, and few living individuals have personal memories of pandemics on the scale of COVID-19, these warnings were easy to ignore. Plus, as we have seen, epidemics are always accompanied by emotional contagions, like fear and denial. And so Americans were caught unprepared, emotionally, politically, and practically. We did not even have the equipment needed, from PPE to tests to ventilators, to save our lives. But most of all, we did not have a collective understanding of the threat we are facing. The COVID-19 pandemic awakened Americans to the importance of public health in the same way that 9/11 opened our eyes to the sophisticated threats to our national security, the Great Recession to the fragility of our financial system, and the election of various populist leaders around the world in the 21st century to the dangers of political extremism. Respiratory pandemics recur. Figure 17 in your PDF focuses just on those caused by influenza over the past 300 years. They have been appearing steadily all this time, every few decades. Especially bad respiratory pandemics occur every 50 to 100 years. COVID-19 will not be the last pandemic. In fact, even as we were coping with the early phases of COVID-19, reports emerged in the summer of 2020 of a new influenza pathogen of unclear severity found during routine ongoing surveillance of pigs in China. It is almost too horrible to contemplate having to face a pandemic from an entirely different class of pathogens overlapping with the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. But the threat is ever present. For all the suffering it has caused, the COVID-19 pandemic also showed people new possibilities. The cessation of movement resulted in clean air and a reduction in carbon emissions on par with what is required, albeit in a more sustained way, to address climate change. Banding together to implement the various NPIs fostered a recognition of the importance of collective will and helped set the stage for political activism to address other long-standing problems in our society, from economic inequality to racial injustice to healthcare inadequacies. The ability of the government to spend vast sums of money in the blink of an eye gave a palpable demonstration of the tremendous economic power it has to address a threat deemed important enough. The pandemic functioned as a kind of object lesson. See what is possible? The COVID-19 pandemic also demonstrated, in very material ways, how interconnected we all are, and how the Commonweal is only as well off as its weakest members. In addition to raising important moral concerns, the existence of vulnerable groups in the United States and around the world who could serve as reservoirs of infection demonstrates the pragmatic utility of showing solidarity. When a deadly contagion is raging, it is in the interests of the strong to care for the weak. And effective disease containment, by definition, puts the needs of the collective ahead of the needs of individuals. In Prometheus Bound, a play by Aeschylus, Prometheus is chained to a rock as punishment for giving humans the gift of fire and thus technology. In addition, he gave us another gift. He made it impossible for us to foresee our own deaths. But since we still know that we can suffer and die because we observe others doing so, this ignorance and uncertainty tends to make us miserable. We can use technology to predict the future, but this can also make things worse if the predictions are both accurate and dire. The chorus in the play asks Prometheus, "What cure did you discover for their misery?" And Prometheus responds, "I planted firmly in their hearts blind hopefulness." But blind hope is a fickle companion for our woe. It is not enough. Still, by forcing our gaze to the future, hope can serve another purpose. It can motivate us to prepare. Microbes have shaped our evolutionary trajectory since the origin of our species. Epidemics have done so for thousands of years. Like the myth of Apollo's arrows, they have been a part of our story all along. We have outlived them before, using the biological and social tools at our disposal. Life will return to normal. Plagues always end. And like plagues, hope is an enduring part of the human condition.